Welcome to WGIL Galesburg Live. Now, this week's host, Terry Cavanaugh.
It's 7:17 here on Galesburg Live. I'm Terry Cavanaugh. Thanks for joining us here this morning. My first guest is local historian and Knox College graduate, Rex Charrington. And Rex is ready for homeoming weekend.
Yes,
and
I am. Good morning, Rex.
Nice to have you here
once again. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, it's a good weekend for a little Knox history, I think.
I was already working on a Knox history project for homecoming, so that worked well.
Yeah, when Rex agreed to come on this morning. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the founding and then the tie-in with some of the early presidents and their contributions to Knox College, and we'll probably get to Alumni Hall, too, which was, established and completed in those...
In 1890, the cornerstone was laid October 7th, 1890, and then 1 year later it was built in 1 year, and that was quite an accomplishment, I think.
Yeah.
So it was dedicated in 1891.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the founding, Rex, and kind of start from the beginnings of Knox.
That makes sense. Our town is Galesburg, so we probably all have heard of Reverend George Washington Gale. He was the visionary and the organizer of the founders. Along with him, there are many people, can't name all the names, but I want to mention the Ferrises, Sylvanus Ferris and his family and how important they were. Reverend Gale was born in Dutchess County, New York, not far from Poughkeepsie, and he was born in 1789, same year as the Constitution was adopted. The year before he was born, there had been a convention in Poughkeepsie where the New York delegates agreed to ratify the Constitution, only 15 miles from where he was born. And apparently his parents had no problem naming him for a Virginia slave owner, which is rather ironic considering how anti-slavery he became. His parents died young. His only brother died young. It seems like he had a rather melancholy childhood. He was raised by the older sisters and their husbands, went on to get a bachelor's degree from Union College in Schenectady, became an ordained Presbyterian minister, one of the few people who would have had a doctorate, I think, in this country. Princeton Theological Seminary is where he got his doctorate, which I think down the road somehow gets connected into Princeton University, but at that time it was a separate Presbyterian school. Gets into the ministry. He had problems with his stomach. It's described as dyspepsia. Took some time off in 1824, went to Virginia, and looked over education and was starting to become more interested in education than the pastorate position that he had held. And he disapproved of Jefferson's plan because Jefferson had divorced religion from education. And Gale's own words, it could not prosper on its present plan. Well, that's been proven wrong. It is among the appointments of God that literature and especially literary institutions cannot flourish except in conjunction with religion. He had two tenets about education. One was it was to be accompanied with religion and that it should be accompanied with work. I did not believe that students should live on charity. And so he went back to New York and founded Oneida Institute, which was a manual labor college where clergymen were educated. But he felt he had gone as far as he could and saw the lure of the frontier and the new hope, new promises, and opportunities. So in 1834, he put together what was called the Circular and Plan for the idea of founding a college and, incidentally, a community. Out here on the frontier, and when he had 34 people sign his circular and plan, he was ready to start moving on it, and that was January 1836, which brings us to the founding. But I was speaking to a group over at Bradley University in Peoria this week and explained how Galesburg was a little different because most places, the college or the town grows up first, and at some point they say, well, we need a college. Well, these people said, we need a college. You know, by the way, I guess we're going to have a town. Mm-hmm. And that was, I mentioned to them that Bradley University came 70 years after the founding of Peoria, which is typical where the founding of Galesburg and Knox College are one and the same. So he got some people together, got them out here, They bought a little bit over 10,000 acres of land at about $1.25 an acre at the land office in Quincy, sold it back to themselves for $5 and upwards per acre, and then used that money as an endowment for the first college. He used the increase. Pretty good plan, and it worked. But it was slow developing at first. There just weren't that many people out here.
Mm-hmm.
I would mention, though, that on February 15th, 1837, the college was chartered as Knox Manual Labor College. And one of those Whig legislators who voted for that resolution was Abraham Lincoln when they obtained their charter. So in 1837, mostly they had a charter and ambition, and that was pretty much what the college was. Hiram H. Kellogg, first president of Knox College, was one of the people who'd signed the circular and plan. And he had also had experience in education. He had owned a school for girls and young women in New York, so he was experienced. In those days, often education was a private enterprise. It was when Gale had the Oneida Institute. He was, I think, a co-owner, and Kellogg had actually owned his own school. So Kellogg did not get here right away. He came in 1838 and was actually appointed an agent of the college from 1838 to 1841. So Knox was actually 4 years getting its first college president.
Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt you there, Rex. We'll take a quick little break, and we'll talk more about Kellogg and Gale coming up in a moment here. Rex Charrington, local historian, our guest, Knox History today on Galesburg Live. 7:26 our time on Galesburg Live. I'm Terry Cavanaugh. My guest this morning is local historian and Knox College graduate Rex Charrington. Rex has been preparing materials for a tour he'll do later today at Knox College, and there was already ceremonies that he was at yesterday, and as you mentioned, at Bradley earlier this week, and we're just kind of reviewing the early history of Knox here. And it was interesting, Rex, when you brought up Ferris for just a moment.
Sure.
There was a story recently on, I don't know if it was Mysteries at the Museum or Mysteries at the Monument, when they were talking about the Chicago World's Fair, and they really wanted something to be spectacular there. And courtesy of Mr. Ferris, or one of the descendants that mm-hmm. built that Ferris wheel. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
it just reminds me of this
story. And it's always good to remember that Ferris's name was George Washington Gale Ferris.
And right in line.
Yeah, yeah, they were all family. Mm-hmm. The Ferrises and the Gale family, they were connected through marriages. And, you know, he's if anyone knows anything about Galesburg, sometimes they often think the Ferris wheel was actually made here, and then I tell them the story how mm-hmm. he was born here and the family went west.
But yeah.
Anyway, getting back to this, Terry, is
yeah,
that okay?
Gale and Kellogg.
Yeah, in 1839, I was mentioning how they sold land and raised the money for the first endowment for the college. And it was fairly successful because, and I don't want to load you up with a lot of facts and figures, but $29,715 was the invested in interest-bearing funds of the college. And I would take that times about 30 or 35 to give you an idea, $1 to 30, mm-hmm. say $35. So they did well in raising the endowment initially. The problem was that they just, you know, were slow in getting enrollment at first.
Mm-hmm.
They built an academy, a preparatory school, before they built the college, which makes sense because they had to get some students ready for the college. And in 1841, while Kellogg was still president, they built the female seminary on Seminary Street. The first building was actually on Seminary. And it was called a female seminary, but it was not to teach women to be clergymen. I don't know why they used the term seminary, but somehow as a distinction from the college. Unfortunately, 2 years later, that building burned. It supposedly had cost more than $5,000 and had no insurance. So they were off to kind of a rough start. Kellogg had been a delegate to the World's Anti-Slavery Convention, and I don't want to understate the importance of this anti-slavery theme in the founding of Knox College and the settlement of Galesburg. It was a hotbed of abolitionism, as often been described, I think accurately. While Kellogg was in England, he attempted to get funds and so forth from the English, and he didn't come back with all that much. Supposedly, the total donations he was able to raise in Europe would have been around $2,000, mostly books more than cash. I often chuckle about that and think, well, it wasn't that long after the Revolution. The British thought we could be trusted with books and we might use the money to buy guns. You never know. So he came back with some books. But all in all, it wasn't working out for Blanchard or for Gale quite the way they'd planned. I have nothing really to show any discontent, but Kellogg was ready to go back to New York and try to get his old school back and get it going. But when he attended the World Convention of Anti-Slavery, he traveled with Reverend Jonathan Blanchard, who at that time was the pastor of the Sixth Presbyterian Church in Cincinnati, ardent abolitionist, anti-slavery guy, and so they were acquainted. Blanchard was ready to leave the pastorate and wanted to get into education. He'd gone to Quincy, Illinois, to interview with a mission institute there, but stopped in Galesburg, talked to Reverend Kellogg. The two of them started a conversation that led to Jonathan Blanchard then becoming the next president of Knox College. He went into the presidency in 1845. He was from Vermont, had this Calvinistic background, much like Gale. And Kellogg was a Congregationalist. Blanchard was a Congregationalist, but had served a Presbyterian church and did well. It apparently increased the membership of that church by 500 during the time that he was in Cincinnati. But he was actually a Congregationalist, and you wouldn't think that Presbyterians and Congregationalists would find all that much to differ about, but apparently they did. But in any case, Blanchard did a great deal for the college and was able to solicit money that Kellogg was never able to touch through his connection. So Blanchard did a great deal to really get the college rolling, put up some new buildings, and got to see the first Knox College class graduate in 1846.
So almost 10 years between the founding of the college and an actual graduating class, am I correct?
Nine years, mm-hmm. Between the charter and the actual graduating class. Because first, of course, they had the academy to get some people ready, and then they started the classes, and 4 or 5 years later, they had a graduating class together.
Let me pause for a look at news, and we'll come back with some of the early presidents that formed and shaped Knox College on the Prairie at that time. Mm-hmm. It's 7:32, and Antoine Martin has a look at the latest news. Rex Charrington, our guest on Galesburg Live. You're listening to Galesburg Live on 93.7 FM and 1400 AM WGIL. I'm Terry Cavanaugh. My guest is local historian and Knox College graduate Rex Charrington. And we've been going through a little bit of Knox history from its early beginnings as George Washington Gale came out from New York and brought others with him, and several others came to the Prairie and established the college. And then there's been some early presidents, most of whom I thought, Rex, were actually pastors or connected to a denomination, looked like, until you reached one. I can't remember which one it was, but it was an oddity almost not to have that connection.
That is true. All the early ones were reverends and had a theological background. Actually, Newton Bateman would have been the first who was not a reverend. He had gone to Lane Theological Seminary for 1 year in Cincinnati, but made a decision not to go toward the ministry and to go toward education instead. Yes, they were. Reverend Blanchard, of course, as I mentioned. So in 1846, the first commencement takes place at Knox. We had nine men receiving their degrees. There were no women. The seminary burned in 1843, And in 1846, when Blanchard got here, it had not been revitalized mm-hmm. yet. So he got the seminary going again. I don't know exactly about the building arrangements then, but anyway, a new academy building was built over where the Broadview is now on Public Square. So a whole lot happened during Blanchard's administration, but the big event, of course, was the bringing of the railroad to Galesburg. Knox College had been set up as a manual labor college and owned about 1,000 acres of land. They were able to sell off that land to the railroad, which is the classification yard, all of the land where the depot was and much of this, it's railroad land, and this brought in a tremendous amount of money for the college. I've not pinned down the exact amount, but this changed everything. This allowed them to build the new building, Knox Female Seminary, which has grown into Whiting Hall, and Old Main, or then called the Main Building. Those two buildings came from the prosperity brought from the railroad. Blanchard liked to claim a little more credit for himself than he probably deserved, but that was okay. It did happen while he was the president. But he fell out of favor with Gale, and they were wrangling, and they finally worked out a plan to get Gale to resign from the Board of Trustees and Blanchard to resign as president, and they both resigned. Of course, they had enough votes to get Reverend Gale back on the board right away. And Blanchard was out. He served as pastor of Old First Church on Public Square, the church that was there before Central Congregational, and finally went on up to Wheaton, Illinois, became the president of Wheaton, once ran for president of the United States on the anti-Masonic ticket. Yeah, he was a rabid anti. He wouldn't even allow the Sons of Temperance to form because they were a secret society, and he was a real temperance man, so that tells you how much he was against the secret societies. So following that, we have a Reverend Harvey Curtis, who was here for 5 years. Unfortunately, his presidency was plagued by the Civil War. Many of the students left to go into the Army. Before the war was over, one-third of the Knox students were in service for the Union cause. He also had health problems with tuberculosis, and so with everything, and he ran into some problems with the Board of Trustees. Reverend Gale died in 1861, but there was still this friction between the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists. The next president was another Curtis, William S. Curtis, and during the war, they were starting to let men and women attend the same classes because their enrollment was down so much they were wanting to fill the classrooms. So men and women got to study together only because there was a war. After the war, William Curtis tried to switch it back over, and the women didn't care for that. There was a woman named Lydia Howard who was principal of the female seminary. She had come from Mount Holyoke, and she'd been in the habit of having their own catalog as opposed to a few pages in the college catalog the way Knox did. And it was William Curtis and Lydia Howard got in a wrangle over her copy that she had written that she wanted published as a separate catalog. And he said no. And on the steps of Whiting or Female Seminary, which is now Whiting Hall, they got into a disagreement, and he grabbed the copy out of her arms, and she was furious. And so she and the other women in the seminary tendered their resignations the next day. There were men students who sided with the women, and they had rifles and were on top of Old Main, hopefully just shooting blanks. But the story goes the police didn't bother to interfere. And surprisingly or not so surprisingly, William Curtis resigned very shortly. Thereafter, Lydia Howard stayed another year and went on to become the first woman college president in the United States at Wellesley College. Which, before I go on to John P. Gulliver, I'd like to mention the Knox Triumvirate. These are names familiar to many. George Churchill, in addition to being on the faculty at Knox for 50 years, is also considered the father of Galesburg's public schools. He was a city engineer and a county engineer and served as alderman quite active and an important figure in the college and the community.
He was on the Board of Trustees, Rex. Is that what you're saying?
George Churchill at Knox was on the faculty.
Okay.
I don't believe he was on the trustees.
He was a faculty member.
Faculty member from 1855 to 1899. And Comstock, Milton Comstock, was a faculty member altogether. Let's see, clear up until his death. 1906 is when he died. So, and he was in the Knox class of 51. Was on the faculty in 51 to 54. Principal of Knox Academy during those years, and then he did serve clear on up till he died in 1906. So altogether, his association with Knox was a little over 50 years. And Albert Hurd, he was the one who did not graduate from Knox. He came from Middlebury College. And and he also was on the faculty from 1851 to 1906, so again, another 50 years. So they were the stable core. While all these presidents were mm-hmm. changing, they were the core group, in many ways held the college together and gave it the stability and the direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through those tenuous tenures, if you will, of,
right.
of presidents. Yeah. Let me break here,
yes.
Rex. It's 7:45 on Galesburg Live. Local historian Rex Cherrington, our guest, with a bit of Knox history on this homecoming weekend. Our time is 7:50 here on Galesburg Live. Coming up at 8:15 this morning, we'll talk with Master Gardener Rhonda Brady, also Master Naturalist Bill Tomlin and Lisa Justice are with us, and hopefully taking some of your fall lawn and garden questions as well. But right now, local historian Rex Cherrington with us in the studios. It's homecoming weekend at Knox, so Rex is tackling a little bit of the history of the early presidents. And because I know that we're going to run out of time,
sure.
we're going to kind of jump to one of the presidents that maybe had a great deal of influence in those early years. And along with that, maybe the addition of Alumni Hall. So, Rex,
okay.
I'll let you kind of take over there as
sure.
we jump ahead.
I'll just to keep the chronology going, I'll mention John Gulliver. He was the president who came after Blanchard. And he was only here 4 years, but Eugene Field was a student during his 4 years, famous poet and journalist. And Cyrus Minor Avery graduated during that time, and he was a great benefactor for the college and was a business that was the largest employer in Peoria, Avery Manufacturing. Anyway, the issue that continued was about the women and whether the women – were going to be educated with the men, and could they earn the same degree? And finally, that was getting worked out by 1872. Newton Bateman comes along in 1874. There was a two-year period after Gulliver was dismissed where they couldn't seem to find. It's about like trying to find someone who wants to be Speaker of the House. I think that mm-hmm. you know that. So Newton Bateman had been superintendent of public instruction in the state of Illinois. As I'd mentioned before, he'd gone to college, went to seminary 1 year, but went toward education. He'd been a regional superintendent of schools, then the state superintendent of schools, and got to know Lincoln. Lincoln referred to him as, my little friend Newton Bateman, the biggest schoolmaster in the state of Illinois. So his connection with Lincoln probably helped him along. But he stayed in Springfield in that position until he came here in 1874. He really worked on developing the academic program. There weren't that many buildings built during his time. There was a gymnasium in 1876, which I gather was built with some reluctance. Knox was not a sports school even back then, but there was a 36 by 72 foot gym I haven't found any pictures of it even. But just to mention some of the graduates during the time that Bateman was president, Harriet Hurd, the daughter of Professor Hurd, who married S.S. McClure. And McClure, of course, had the publishing firm, McClure's Magazine. There were also book publishers, a New York publishing firm that was a very large company, and at one time their magazine had the largest circulation of any magazine in the country. There were other people associated with him, John Phillips was one. Well-known historian Edgar Bancroft graduated during those years, and Robert Mather, who was worked his way up through the various railroads and was eventually president of the Rock Island, and was later chairman of the board of Westinghouse, and John Finley, who was Bateman's successor, the next president, who at the time would have been the youngest president in the United States, college president in the United States. So the most significant building accomplishment during Bateman's time is Alumni Hall, and quite an accomplishment. Terry, you probably have some questions. Maybe I'll let you take
well,
over.
Well, I wonder, now Bateman, was he the one that didn't have like a denomination behind him? It was more educational?
Right. By that time, the college was moving away from this, a lot of the away from the reliance on religious funding. So, yes, he was not a reverend. He had gone 1 year to theology school and then decided to take a different course. So I think of him as being the first non-clergyman president. But because he'd gone to theology school, some say that his successor, Finley, was the first because Finley had no theology school whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Finley, of course, went on to become the editor of the New York Times after he left here.
How did Alumni Hall come about? Where did they find the funding for such a building? Rex, do you have any information on that?
Yeah, a little bit. The need for the building was certainly there. The college hadn't done any building really since Old Main and the female seminary had been built. The female seminary was still in a smaller form before the wings that were added on that eventually became Whiting Hall. And so the alumni saw the need. At first it was going to be a Christian fellowship center was what many of the alums had envisioned the need for that, but it turned out that the two competing societies on campus, these were literary societies, they engaged in debate and they competed in many ways. They were known as the Greek word nathotiai was the one group and the Adelphi was the other group. Sort of fraternities, societies, they were not secret, although Adelphi was the successor to a secret society that once they found out existed was banned, and in 1846 the Adelphi formed. So Alumni Hall was, the money was raised by three groups. You had the Nathotii group, the Adelphi group, and the Alumni group. They were all alums, but the two literary societies raised their own money. And some paid into both the alumni fund and their respective literary societies. This Avery from Peoria I mentioned was a large donor and very active and very instrumental in getting donations from other people. The poor architect had to work with three committees, which explains a lot about the building and why it's so non-symmetrical. If you look at the building and you go around to the south side, not on South Street, but the other side of the building, you'll see the words Nathotii over one set of doors on one end, and Adelphi on the other set of doors on the other end of the building. Presumably, the middle of the building would be the alumni portion of the building. Those who are familiar with the old floor plan know how it was chopped up, and really it was like three different buildings in one. E.E. Myers from Detroit was the architect who had been the architect for the Knox County Courthouse a few years earlier. And so he had to work with this. I would like to know if he had any difficulty in accepting it. I suspect that he would have liked to have done the building differently, but he had to work for the customer.
Mm-hmm. And so he had three
groups to work with.
Yeah.
What a headache. couldn't admire any part of that.
any word on what that would have cost at the time, Rex?
Various figures. I've tried to sort that out. I went through some records at the Knox Archives trying to come up with the figure, and I don't know. It seems like the roundabout talked about amount was around $70,000. less than what the courthouse had cost. The courthouse cost $156,000 in 1885, 86 when it was constructed. So not as expensive as the courthouse, but still probably the second most expensive structure in Galesburg.
Mm-hmm. And what year was it completed
Well, completed in 1891. President Benjamin Harrison was here for the laying of the cornerstone October 7th, 1890. And then one year later, they dedicated the building.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've been talking to local historian and Knox College graduate Rex Charrington on some of the early presidents and alumni hall on the Knox College campus. Happy homecoming to all the alumni and those returning to the college this weekend. And Rex, I always appreciate your time here on Galesburg Live, and thanks for coming
You're
in this morning.
You're most welcome, Terry, anytime.
Yes, enjoy the day with your colleagues and friends and those new friends you like to meet during homecoming weekend.
I go to homecoming and always meet new people.
That's a good idea.